for the people of the state of Alaska.
Please be seated.
For the people of Nova Scotia.
We're here for argument in the case of David S. Hague versus State of Alaska. It's number 9455 and 10015. Hague, if you're ready, you may begin.
Hey, please support. My name is David Hague. Our Constitution guarantees fundamental fairness. I did not receive fundamental fairness. The constitutional rights violated in my case are equal protection under law, due process, double jeopardy, self-incrimination, nature and cause of accusation, compulsory process for witnesses, assistance to counsel, and unreasonable searches and seizures. My case started out with the state claiming they found the evidence of wrongdoing in a place where it wasn't found. In essence, they moved the evidence. They maybe didn't move the evidence, but they claimed it was found in a different game management unit. The unit they claimed it was found in was where I'm licensed to guide. Evidence was actually found in a game management unit in which a wolf control program was taking place, in which I was participating.
Well, I've reviewed your testimony at the trial, and according to your testimony, all nine of the wolves were in fact taken outside the area where you had the permit.
I've read a lot of law. It makes to make sure something's fair, they have to follow certain things. Due process is one thing in due process is the government is not allowed to make false claims, even if something's wrong. The risk is that you may be charged with the wrong crime or pay a punishment that you're not deserving, and that's what I'm claiming.
Okay.
It started out with they put the wrong game management unit on every search warrant that was used to seize all of my property that I use to provide a livelihood. We entered into plea negotiations with the state. I informed them that the evidence was not found where they say it was. After the plea negotiations broke down, they persisted in claiming that the evidence was found where I guide after they had been told, and they taped me telling them this. Upon immediate cross-examination, they admitted that the evidence was not found where I guide. It was all found in a game management unit in which the wolf control program was taking place. And the taint of that was proven at sentencing, even though upon cross-examination, the state admitted the wrong. The very judge, when I was sentenced, said the reason for my sentence is because most, if not all, the wolves were killed where you guide. And that is a completely false statement. Not a single wolf was killed where I guide. The Supreme Court says that a nation, a free and strong nation, cannot abide by conviction based on false testimony known to the state. And they knew that that testimony to my judge and jury was false. There is no doubt about that. When they seized my property, they seized my airplane, which is the primary means by which I provide for my family. I have a wife and two daughters. They did not give me no notice of a hearing so I could contest or even ask to bond the property out. So immediately, before I was even charged, I could not make a living. I was not charged for 8 months. For 8 months, I had no income. It was a year and a half before I went to trial, and it was decided that the property should be forfeited. On no warrant, and no information, and no charge, did they ever say that they wanted to forfeit my property. And the Supreme Court says that there can be no forfeiture or use as evidence when you did not have notice that they intended to forfeit it, or they did not give you notice of a hearing within days, if not hours, of seizing property that's used as the primary means to provide a livelihood. I was not a lawyer and I did not know I could contest. The state claims that no notice is needed, but it's in direct violation of U.S. and Alaska Supreme Court cases.
Let me ask you, did you talk to the judge about the forfeiture at your sentencing hearing?
Correct. That was a big item. But at that point, we didn't know to prepare. We didn't know that we could bond the property out. We had no notice that there was no official notice up until that point that the property would be sought to be forfeited. And the main thing is that I was deprived of my income with no opportunity to contest because I didn't know for a very long length of time. And I asked the trooper that was seizing the property, can I get my plane back? Because I have clients coming in the day after they seize my plane, and he says, never. He'll never get your plane back. Well, in commercial, in fishing boat seizures in Bristol Bay, when you have a two-week season, if a trooper seizes your boat and sits on it for 2 weeks, that trooper effectively cost you a whole season's income. You may not know that you could go bond it out or even say, hey, it was somebody else. I'd like to point out that the statutes that the state used, I believe it's 1605, 190, and 195, I believe are unconstitutional as written because they require no prompt notice of a hearing when the property is seized. They require no prompt notice that the items may be forfeited. So essentially those statutes allow property to be seized without due process followed. I also, after that happened, there was plea negotiations. We arrived at a plea agreement. That plea agreement was arrived at in August. For that plea agreement, I had to give a statement, a five-hour statement to the prosecution. It required me to give up guiding for at least 1 year, and also to talk about a moose hunt. I took and gave up guiding for the year. I gave up September and October, and if you guys hunt, you know moose season is in September. That's what we primarily do, and bear season is in October. In November, the state filed charges that was in agreement with the plea agreement, and then 5 business hours before we're supposed to fly to McGrath and present the plea agreement to the judge, they filed an amended information changing the charges. And what that did is two things. It violated the plea agreement after there was enormous detrimental reliance put on it. Not only a five-hour statement, which the state used, but my wife and I, both who depend on guiding for our entire livelihood, was gone. I got nothing. And we flew in it happened so close. They changed the charges so close to the time at which it was supposed to happen that we'd already flown in witnesses from as far away as Illinois. We had bet the farm on this plea agreement, and after we bet the farm on it, and the farm was gone, they pull it away from us. And I asked, how can they do that to my attorney? He said, it's the way the game's played. Well, I don't think that's fair. I don't think anybody would think that's fair. They then used, since I had agreed to talk about this moose issue for that plea agreement, after I was convicted on the harsher charges, they said, well, since Dave Hegg agreed for this moose issue to enhance his sentence for these lesser charges, it means Dave Hegg agreed for this moose thing to enhance his sentence on these harsher charges. So not only did they break it at that time, later on down the line he used it. Supreme Court says you can't break a paid-for plea agreement or change charges without justification. You cannot increase the severity of charges or the number of charges without going before the court and proving justification, because they say basically that there's the likelihood of vindictive or the appearance of vindictiveness if they do that. Okay, then I told you that I gave a statement. After they changed the charges, they used them not only for the original information that they filed in agreements with the plea negotiation, they used it for the amended information, my statements. They said, Dave Hegg came in and said this, this, and this, so it essentially provided probable cause for a whole lot of charges that they had absolutely no evidence for. Evidence Rule 410 states, to foster negotiations, the rule provides that nothing that is said during plea bargaining may be used against the accused in any proceeding, whether criminal, civil, or administrative. Thus, the accused is free to discuss the case without resort to hypothetical statements of fact, and without fear that a slip of the tongue may be devastating at a later trial or other proceeding. I was devastated by my own statement that I gave for a plea agreement that then vanished. They used the statement and all the informations. They used the statement to obtain their main witness against me at trial. They gave my statements to the media. It was published around the world, my statements admitting what we had done. And they used it to enhance my sentence. I hired a gentleman named Brent Cole to represent me. I asked him about all this. He says, you can't do anything. All you can do is call Leader's boss. Leader's was a prosecutor. I said, is that all I can do? He said, that's all you can do. I was so concerned after I hired my next attorney and went to trial and lost. I was so angry and so upset and so frustrated over all I had given for nothing that I subpoenaed Mr. Cole to my sentencing. I bought him an airline ticket. I bought him a hotel room. I paid for his witness fees. And then Mr. Cole never showed up. My second attorney said, there's nothing you can do about that, Mr. Higg. He said, go to trial. Well, he said that after we'd been to trial, but when I first hired Mr. Robinson, he said, there's nothing you can do about what happened with Mr. Cole. You have to move forward. It's all water under the bridge. He says, go to trial. He says, don't put on any evidence. I have a tactic that there's no subject matter jurisdiction. Well, me being fighting for my life and fighting for my family and everything I've built in my life, I said, I'm going to help Mr. Robinson create the best tactic, the best defense known to man. So I did my research. He said that for the subject matter jurisdiction to work, you can't talk about the plea agreement or all that you did for it or admit to the court that there was jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction. He said, don't bring up any of that, Dave. Don't talk about it. Well, I started looking at subject matter jurisdiction. AS 2215.060, criminal jurisdiction. The district court has jurisdiction, one, of the following crimes. A misdemeanor. I was charged with a misdemeanor in district court. There was nothing else the district court needed for jurisdiction. Why would Mr. Robinson have me hide all of the other constitutional violations in my case for a tactic that irrefutably would never work? He then failed to enforce the subpoena against Mr. Cole. I was then given an illegal sentence. They revoked my guide license for 5 years. It could only be suspended. That revocation caused me to lose numerous guiding camps that I pay leases on to the federal government because they said if it was suspended, you still have a license and will allow you to keep the camps. Since it says revoked, you have no license. Those camps must be removed. I removed those camps because of an illegal sentence that my own attorney never objected to. My own attorney says I cannot appeal the sentence. And the judge in my case told me that, never told me I could appeal the sentence. So I didn't know, I knew I was appealing the conviction, but nobody told me I could appeal the sentence. And in fact, my attorney told me I couldn't appeal the sentence. Mr. Robinson, points of appeal that he submitted you prove what I'm telling you about the subject matter jurisdiction is true and about the other stuff. After I figured out, after I became very unhappy with Mr. Robinson, I hired Mr. Osterman, my third attorney. After a week of looking at all the evidence, he said it was the biggest sellout he'd ever seen. And let me put back up a moment. Because of the problems with my first two attorneys and what I felt the lies told to me, I tape recorded every single word I ever had with Mr. Osterman. Every word, from the day I called him up to hire him to the day I fired him. He said it was the biggest sellout he'd ever seen by attorneys, that I didn't know my attorneys were going to, quote, load the dice so the state would always win. He said Robinson's no jurisdiction, no subject matter jurisdiction tactic was no good. Me and him, were going to sue Mr. Cole and Mr. Robinson. after my conviction was overturned. A month later, Mr. Osterman, I couldn't get a hold of him for a month, and my deadline for my appeals come up, or for the brief to you, to this court, was coming up. A month later, he told me that Mr. Robinson's tactics were good about the subject matter jurisdiction. When I asked him about all the other things that I had on those two attorneys, he told me, quote, "I can't affect their lives and livelihoods." Well, I found case law in the U.S. Supreme Court and in Alaska Supreme Court that says if you can prove that a conflict of interest of your attorney, that he was representing interests in conflict with yours, that you don't even have to prove prejudice, because the likelihood of prejudice to a defendant whose attorney is representing interests in conflict with that defendant, it's automatic ineffective assistance. There need be no proof of prejudice. Okay? In my appeal, there have been what I feel are errors. I haven't been able to stay my appeal so I can go post-conviction relief, subpoena in the attorneys, and prove exactly what went on. My illegal sentence was not fixed. I lost approximately $100,000 in camps because of my illegal sentence not being fixed.
Mr. Higg, on the question of the illegality of your sentence, on the part about whether it should have been suspended or revoked, I was just looking through the file. Last August, this court issued an order saying that you could, in fact, go back to the district court and ask for correction of the sentence. Did you do that?
No, I did not, okay. Your Honor. What happened is I asked this court, and this court, I believe, said, although we could fix your sentence, we will not do so until we decide your appeal. And the federal government said, camps better be gone. So camps were gone, and now it no longer matters. Although, now, if I got to go get my guide license, it no longer will it just be unsuspended off and become an assistant guide for 5 years, become a registered guide for 13 years, to become the master guide I used to be. So instead of a suspension, it will be an 18-year end of my guide career because of a revoked sentence, or revoked guide license. Okay? Some other things that I don't think are quite right. When Magistrate Woodmansey was assigned to rule on whether I could represent myself, he was involved in my original trial, and he'd throw up his hands in frustration whenever we would try to assert my rights. So I tried to recuse him according to law. I submitted an affidavit in the time required under AS 2220-022, and he never was removed. And that's a law, says that if you want to recuse somebody and you submit an affidavit, which you did, without requiring proof, and immediately that judge shall be recused. But not in my case. I don't know. 2 years ago, I started trying to get my property back because of the due process violations. It's now over 2 years since I started that. I don't really mean to harp, but I had to tell the courts that I was going to go get my property before anyone would actually hear my request for my property. Everybody said, the district court said you had jurisdiction, you said they had jurisdiction, even though you both had the orders. I didn't think that was fair. That was 2 years ago. I'm getting hungry. I mean, we're done. We can't go on forever. It's 4 years since this stuff started. The property hearing with Woodmansey, he made it constitutionally ineffective. The U.S. Supreme Court says when you're fighting for your property, you can submit evidence, you can cross-examine adverse witnesses, you can present witnesses, and you can have oral argument. Mr. Woodmansey says you can't submit evidence, you can't cross-examine adverse witnesses, you can't present witnesses, and there will be no oral argument. Well, when I read what the U.S. Supreme Court says I need to get my property back for a fair fight, and the magistrate says no, I don't think that's fair. He made an adverse decision, decided I couldn't get all my property back. I then appealed that decision, and it's been over a year since then. And another summer's coming up. It's May. June and July, August, September is when I make my livelihood. I need my property back. I would like to ask this court for an immediate return of all my property, and I'd like your honors to look at the order of the 1st of January 2008, granting expedited consideration. That was in January. It's now May. And two more grantings for expedited consideration and expedited decision issued on March 6, 2008. I'd ask this court to declare that 12.35.020 and 025 and AF 1605-190 and 195 are unconstitutional as written because they don't provide for due process. I'd like a reversal of my convictions with prejudice because of vindictive and malicious prosecution and ineffective assistance counsel. I would like this court to recommend civil and criminal proceedings for those involved. And I would like a ruling on all issues from this court so that there can be some justice or some resolution in my case. And I'm out of time and I thank you very much unless you have any more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden. Mr. Peterson?
Police Court. My name is Andrew Peterson. I'm Assistant Attorney General with the Office of Special Prosecutions. The claims set forth by Mr. Hague in his brief can really be lumped into kind of two categories. There are those claims which should be brought as part of a post-conviction relief application with the trial court in McGrath, and then there are claims which are being raised for the very first time in this appeal. Starting with the PCR issues, Mr. Hague alleges a number of wrongs that he believes demonstrates ineffective assistance of counsel by his two prior trial attorneys, issues committed by prosecutors, which they never objected to, and acts by the judge in the case, which his lawyers never objected to as well. This court has held that an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is not appropriate on direct appeal, absent plain error. And the problem here for Mr. Hague is showing plain error. In Berry, this court held that it will seldom find ineffective assistance of counsel for the simple reason that there's no explanation in the record before the court that tells the court why the trial attorneys did what they did. Was it a tactical decision or not? We don't have that information before us. It's not in the record. His attorneys never challenged any of the issues that he raises, and therefore there was no hearings, there was nothing in the trial court that would give this court an understanding of why his lawyers did what they did. Now, Mr. Hague has indicated in his briefing that he's been denied the right to file a post-conviction relief application. In part, that's true. He filed a PCR application in McGrath while he was still represented by counsel, but he filed it himself. He was told once he was determined that he could run pro se, he could refile his post-conviction relief application. He hasn't done so yet. And this court should indicate that that is how he should address most of the wrongs that he's alleging. The second grouping really falls into waiver. These claims that he's raising for a first time on appeal, Monroe addresses those. He not only has to show plain error, he has to show substantial prejudice and that these errors he alleges are not tactical. And he has to overcome the presumption that his trial attorneys were competent. Starting with the issues that he raises, the first one is the constitutionality of his property seizures. He alleges that he was violated, he was denied due process because he wasn't told he had an immediate right to a hearing to get his property back. That simply isn't true. He had an immediate right under Criminal Rule 37C to seek the return of his property and the suppression of evidence which was seized. His property was seized subject to a validly executed search warrant. Mr. Hague was present during the seizure on March 29th of 04. Less than 2 weeks later, he hired Mr. Cole. No motion was ever filed under Criminal Rule 37C to seek the return of his property. When he was ultimately arraigned on the original or the amended information, Criminal Rule 12 takes place. He or his counsel had 45 days to file a motion. No motion was ever filed seeking the return of his property. The only motion that was filed was in July 8th of 2005, a motion seeking to bond out his property. In the state's opposition, the state indicated that it was seeking the forfeiture of the property under the applicable statutes, and that it objected to the return of the property, and the court denied its request for bonding the property up. Bottom line here is that Mr. Haig wasn't denied due process. He had the right to seek the return of his property under Criminal Rule 37. He didn't avail himself of that right, and consequently he can't now come in before this court and claim that he's been denied due process. The next issue he raises is that of the alleged perjury by Trooper Gibbons. Trooper Gibbons stated in his affidavit for the search warrant that he saw a sign of somebody committing the act of same-day airborneing of wolves in a subunit of 19, Game Management Unit 19, and then he indicated he went back the next day, followed the tracks, and found the wolf kills, which were outside of the predator control zone. Trooper Gibbons testified at trial consistent with what was in his affidavit, and then upon cross-examination, he corrected himself. He said, no, actually it wasn't in 19C, it was in 19D, but it was outside of the wolf control program. The importance here is anytime you go outside of this predator control program area, the boundary, you are now committing the act of same-day airborne. It doesn't matter if it was in 19B, 19C, where it was. As long as you're outside of that zone, which allows you legally to be same-day airborne in wolves, you're committing the act of the crime of same-day airborne. And then as the court's already pointed out, not only did Trooper Gibbons testify at trial consistent with what was in the affidavit and correct his mistake, but then Mr. Haig testified at trial and admitted to killing the wolves outside of the predator control zone. He testified at sentencing and admitted again, and then he submitted excerpts to this court which indicate that he was outside of the control zone. So the state would argue there is no there's no error here. He's waived this issue, was never raised, but even if the court was to consider whether or not there's plain error, there's certainly no substantial prejudice to Mr. Haig because he's admitted committing the crime repeatedly. The next issue he raises is the state's violation of using his plea agreement statements against him. The state's first argument with respect to that would be that he's waived any right to raise this claim. His lawyers never raised it when he was arraigned. It was never raised prior to trial. Now, Mr. Haig indicated that it was raised in a reply brief filed by his attorney prior to trial. It was actually raised in an affidavit attached to the reply brief by Mr. Haig, which the state would argue doesn't preserve it for appeal. The second thing that Mr. Haig overlooks in this case is that his co-defendant, Mr. Zellers, also gave statement to the prosecutor and the trooper in this case. His co-defendant waived evidence rule 410, and his co-defendant testified at trial. There's no indication that any of the information used in the amended information or used to prosecute him at trial was information that could not have been gathered from Mr. Zellers. So again, the state would argue that there's this issue's been waived, but even if the court were to consider whether or not there was plain error here, it would be that there's no prejudice to Mr. Haig because all that information came out or could have come out through his co-defendant. Mr. Haig raises a number of claims with respect to judicial misconduct.
Before we leave this issue, Mr. Haig has also raised the issue of detrimental reliance on the plea bargain and then the state changing the charges at the last moment.
Certainly, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, I would answer that by saying, first of all, his attorney never raised any objection, and we don't know why. It's not in the record before this court. The only way we're ever going to know why is through post-conviction relief application, where his attorney can be deposed and we can ask why. Now, through other proceedings, I believe I know why there was no objection raised and why the plea negotiations broke down, but that's not in the record before this court. Okay. The next area of claims that Mr. Haig raises is a number of issues of alleged judicial misconduct. The state intends to rely on its pleadings for most of them. The only issue that the state would like to briefly address is that of the judge's failure to give a required jury instruction. Essentially, in Mr. Haig's briefing, he claimed that there was a required accomplice instruction that needed to be given it was required by law. First of all, the state would argue that he's waived this issue. His own lawyer never asked for this instruction. But second, no accomplice instruction has been required in the state of Alaska since 1975. Longley v. State sets that forth. And Mossberg v. State states that the decision to give an accomplice instruction is generally a tactical decision. Again, this would indicate to the court that the decision to not give this instruction, or at least not to ask for it, is certainly an issue for PCR, not for a merit appeal. And finally, Mr. Haig he asked for a number of forms of relief. I believe I have addressed most of those, or all of them, in my briefing, and I'm going to rely on the briefing with respect to everything except for his guide's license issue. He claims first that the court's order is illegal because it calls for a revocation and not a suspension. Alaska Statute 854.720.F3 provides that the court shall suspend the license for a minimum of 3 years or may permanently revoke the license. So the court has the option. Now, in this case, the court stated that it was revoking it for a period of 5 years. There's certainly no indication, first off, that that's an illegal sentence. And second,
doesn't it sound like Judge Murphy intended to suspend it for five? Because your options are revoke, end of story, or suspend.
Looks on the judgment form, there's only the word revoke. There's not the word suspend. It looks like Judge Murphy just kind of, without thinking, used the form and didn't strike out revoke and say suspend.
And I don't disagree with that, but Mr. Haig could have raised this issue, as this court has indicated, with the trial court, and I'm not certain, I don't know that I would have objected to him asking to have...
But you object now if it's modified to being a five-year suspension? Shouldn't we modify it to that?
Certainly, if the court feels it has the authority to modify it now, despite him not originally raising it with the trial court, I don't have an objection.
You tell the trial court to do it.
Sure. Right? Now, the only issue, though, this brings me to the next issue. Whether it's a suspension or revocation, it makes no difference. Occupational licensing treats it the exact same. Because of the 2-year periods in which guide licenses are valid for, a 5-year suspension or a 5-year revocation, at the end of that period, Mr. Haig is going to have to reapply for his guide's license. I don't believe under either scenario he has to start over as an assistant guide. He still has all the requisite experience to become a master guide again. He just needs to reapply for his license.
Well, now, I mean, regardless of what consequence it might have, he's entitled to have the judgment amended, right?
Certainly.
Okay. Right. And then the consequences are not really before us at this point.
Yeah. Exactly. The last issue with respect to his guide's license is his request to stay the revocation, or if the court's going to change it, the suspension of his license. And the state would oppose that, as it has in the past, for a number of reasons. First of all, if the court were to stay the suspension of his license at this point in time, the state would be entitled to bail conditions. The trial court has the authority and the broad discretion to issue bail conditions. One of the conditions the state would ask for is that he not be involved in any type of guiding activities pending this appeal. And there's good reason for that. Title 8 regulates the activities of big game guides. They have the privilege of guiding in the state of Alaska, and one of the things that the state requires is not only that they not commit crimes while they're actually guiding somebody, but Title 8 requires that they not commit any fish and game violation. And in fact, it authorizes prosecution under Title 8 if somebody commits any state or federal wildlife violation, even a regulation. And it doesn't even have to be a violation committed in the state of Alaska. And the explanation is obvious. If we trust them to follow the law when they're guiding somebody in the field for monetary gain, we don't want that same person then on their own to be going around committing fish and game crimes, but at the same time think we're going to trust them when they're guiding. So the state would be asking for a bail condition prohibiting him from guiding if his revocation or suspension was stayed. And with that, I don't believe I have any additional comments unless the court has any questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Haig, this is your time to respond to the arguments that Mr. Peterson has raised.
Okay, Your Honors, Mr. Peterson says that if there even was plain error, that this court shouldn't do anything. And I think that the purpose of courts of appeals are to fix plain error, especially error that had an effect on the individual. And I think that that has been shown over and over. Mr. Peterson also says that there was no need to give me notice of a hearing because the opportunity was available to me. And in essence, Mr. Peterson makes the argument that it's my own fault I didn't know I could ask. Okay. I'd like this court to read the U.S. Supreme Court case Memphis Light, Gas, and Water. It states the purpose of notice under the Due Process Clause is to apprise the affected individual of and permit adequate preparation for an impending hearing. Notice in a case of this kind does not comport with constitutional requirements when it does not advise the customer of the availability of procedure for protesting a proposed termination. Mr. Peterson also goes on to kind of allude that since it was a criminal seizure that does away with that need, and that since it was available, that's all that need be. I'd like this court to also look at Fuentes versus Chevin, another U.S. Supreme Court case. If an applicant for the writ to see something knows that he is dealing with an uneducated, uninformed consumer with little access to legal help and little familiarity with legal procedures, there may be a substantial possibility that a summary seizure of property, however unwarranted, may go unchallenged, and the applicant may feel that he can act with impunity. Appellant Fuente says that in her case, she was never told that she could recover the stove and stereo. And of course, no hearing need be held unless the defendant, having received notice of his opportunity, takes advantage of it. I think it's pretty clear that there's an affirmative duty when the state comes and seizes property from someone who's not a lawyer, that they have to tell them that you have the right to contest this before a judge and to have the state put on proof for taking away your means of putting food in your family's mouth. Perkins versus City of West Covina, Ninth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals. Here the notice left at Perkins' home did not mention the availability of any procedure for protesting the seizure of his property, let alone the existence of a formal judicial procedure for obtaining return. The notice was skeletal, like the notice that the Memphis Light Court found unconstitutional. This is very close to what Mr. Peterson is telling you right now. The city charges Perkins with the responsibility for his own confusion. It cites his failure to persist and to unearth the proper remedy and the method of its invocation. The risk of erroneous deprivation, especially in the emergency situations often underlying search warrants, is substantial. By contrast, the administrative and fiscal burden of providing adequate written notice is slight. All they would have had to do is write a little note on the search warrants. Said, Mr. Haig, you have the opportunity to go for a judge, contest it, or maybe even just to ask to bond the stuff out until a jury determines you should be put out of business. I didn't get that.
The notice must inform the recipient of the procedure for contesting the seizure or retention of the property taken, along with any additional information required for initiating that procedure in the appropriate court. And I think I alluded to, there's three cases, Baranoff, I think the best one is Fishing Vessel American Eagle. It says when the property is used by the person in providing a livelihood, that notice must be given within days, if not hours. I was never given that notice. I hired an attorney 2 weeks after they took my airplane and my property, and I had clients coming in the very next day, and I told the troopers that, and the troopers said, you're never going to get your property back. That's the notice I received. The idea of wage garnishment in advance of judgment, of trustee process, of wage attachment, or whatever is called, is a most inhumane doctrine. It compels the wage earner, trying to keep his family together, to be driven below the poverty level. That's me and my family. Mr. Peterson speaks about, during plea negotiations, we said that we took wolves outside the area. I'd like to let the court know that a week before we went on the wolf control program, I was at the Board of Game meeting in Fairbanks, speaking with a sitting Board of Game member who sits today on the Board of Game. And that gentleman told me that with this first experimental wolf control program, that they had very few wolves, that they had to have more wolves, or the program would be seen as ineffective. He then went on to say that if we took wolves outside the area, to just mark them on our GPS as inside the area. That is a person appointed by the governor that sits on the Alaska Board of Game. And you may think that that was never brought up. That was in my statement that was given to the court, the trial court, the district court, for a plea agreement. And that statement remains there. As far as the plea agreement, I did everything I could to enforce that plea agreement, and everybody, my own attorneys, told me there's nothing you can do. Mr. Peterson says that you should overlook the use of my own statements because they had my co-defendant's statement. My co-defendant has testified under oath along with his attorney that he cooperated with the state because of my statement, which was given first. So that whole thing is a fruit of my statement. In other words, everything the state got as far as knowledge of what went on came from my statement. Whether it came from me or not, whether they went to someone else who felt compelled to talk, that's it's just the way it was. As far as my revocation of a guide license compared to suspension, I want to know who's going to give me my camps back. I asked the courts to fix something that should have been very clear, and nobody did, and I lost $100,000 in camps. Who is going to give me my camps back? Mr. Peterson says that since we took wolves outside the area, it makes no difference. That automatically turns it into a fish and game case. I applied for and received the wolf control permit. That specifically said, anyone participating is potentially excluded from any fish and game violations. They still could have a violation, but it wouldn't affect fish and game. The reason why it affected my guide license is because fish and game violations affect your guide license. I think it's quite the coincidence that the evidence that was found in the game management unit in which the wolf control program was taking place all of a sudden appeared, according to the state, where I guide. I think that's a pretty significant fact, along with the fact that I paid, we informed them of that, and they persisted in that trial, and Mr. Gibbons, Trooper Gibbons, just didn't remember. It was under cross-examination. If you look at the
the statute for perjury, someone can correct themselves up until the time at which it is likely or shown that they're going to be found out. It was only when Mr. Trooper Gibbons knew he had been found out and was being questioned on it, he says, I forgot. It was all in Game Management Unit 19D and not where you guide. Do anybody here believe that if he wouldn't have been cross-examined, that would have ever came out? It would not have come out. And the prejudice of that, the taint, and see, I never really knew how something could be tainted if you fixed it. But the taint of that is proven by the sentencing judge that says the reason for this severe sentence, even though you have no criminal history whatsoever, is because most, if not all, the wolves are taken where you guide, and that is simply an absolute falsehood. So upon cross-examination, there was no, the taint was still there. I want fair proceedings. I would like this court to give me fair proceedings. I had a closing thing I'd like to say, but I'm out of time, and thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Haig. Counsel, we will take the case under advisement, and you stand adjourned.